This podcast is a proud member of the Lamb Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.
Hello, and welcome to the Asian Cinema Film Club. This is episode 2 of the ongoing series where myself and Stephen will be introducing you to the weird and wonderful world of Asian cinema. As I said already, I'm joined by my co-host and general partner in crime from Guilio Ramblings and Eastern Kicks. It gives me great pleasure to welcome back Stephen Palmer. Obviously, before we get into our selection for this episode, which is the Toho's second stab at the King Kong franchise with King Kong Escapes from 1967. We've got just a few bits and pieces. First of all, we have to say a very happy birthday to Stephen, who recently celebrated his birthday.
Thank you very much. We won't say what age it was, but it's done now.
So, of course, obviously, being a film fan, did you get anything film-related for your birthday, or was it?
Do you know, I did. My colleagues at work banded together and bought me one of these sort of film directory sort of reference guides all about Asian and Asian American cinema. So that was a bit of a shock, actually, but I will be thumbing through that for bits and pieces over the next few months, I'm sure.
Yeah, you can never have too many film guides. I think between DVD Delirium and like the Scarecrow film guide, there's a couple of good ones out there, especially for the for Asian cinema. There's the guide to like new Japanese cinema in particular, which is pretty good. And you've obviously got films like the books, like the Tom Mez's books on Takashi Miike Agitator, which is also well worth checking out as well if you're Asian cinema fans. So yeah. I look forward to obviously hearing back from you, and obviously if that was any good,
I will let you know.
Also, since our last episode, you went to the cinema and saw the live-action version of Ghost in the Shell, which I've heard nothing but mixed reviews of since it's come out. And this is obviously a title that people were very skeptical about when Scarlett Johansson got cast as the Major. Then we saw the trailer and everyone got excited about it. And then it came out and people don't know whether to like it or to sort of blast it. So, I mean, what was your sort of thoughts on it?
Well, I wrote a review for Eastern Kicks, and I felt almost as if I was fighting against the tide, because quite clearly people who love the anime and the manga are probably set against it anyway. If, however, you go to it as a fairly thoughtful, brilliantly shot, imaginative sci-fi movie, it's really pretty good. It's not earth-shattering or groundbreaking or anything like that, but it looks good. It tells a story. Now, I think I say in my review is that actually it's less inspired by Ghost in the Shell than it is by RoboCop, because it sort of eschews a lot of the sort of the metaphysical and the side of it that we talked about last time, and is more interested in a sort of a governmental conspiracy and people's memories that have been transplanted into other heads. I'm trying to avoid the spoilers, but at the same time, it hits a lot of beats from the original, and some scenes are live actioned, and I actually pretty much enjoyed it. It's a solid sort of 3.5 out of 5 I think I gave it, and I think that's fair enough. If you want to go in hating it, it's not going to turn your opinion around. But yeah, if you want to just accept it for what it is, as an iteration, as a use of the source media to make a film, there are way worse films you can go and watch. That. So I assume you haven't seen it yet.
I haven't seen it yet. This is mainly because I just haven't had a chance to get to the cinema. I rarely get a chance to get to the cinema, you know, just due to real life responsibilities. I'm not one of these hip independents who can just go on a whim. So it takes a little more planning, and at the moment it looks like my next cinema trip is going to be for Alien Covenant. So I have a feeling that, especially with the mixed reviews of Ghost in the Shell, that I think it's one I'm going to probably wait until it like comes out on DVD or Blu-ray or whatever comes first.
I think it's certainly worth a sort of a Blu-ray purchase. There's a lot going, you know, visually. I mean, as we probably expected from the director, you know, it's not flashy, it's not clever, but the the actual creation of the world that it's in is really well done. And Takashi Kitano steals the show in the scenes that he's in. Gets two of the best lines and the best moments. Scarlett Johansson is perfectly good. You know, it's not a horror. It's not a horrible, horrible film, which I think a lot of people are just saying it is out of probably just down to respect to the original.
Yeah. I know people are very protective of the original property, much like Akira. So I think with, obviously, with Ghost in the Shell having all this buzz surrounding it, there's obviously the rumour mill has gone into overdrive once again with people saying that they're going to do Akira. But, you know, we've been talking about doing Akira for like the last 17 years. So I don't think it's coming anytime soon.
I don't think so. I don't think Ghost in the Shell has done fantastic box office. I have a feeling it'll do rather well in sort of home media, but I don't think it failed against The Boss Baby, you know. So it's not going to be the start of a new sort of wave of films based on or Western films based on anime and manga.
No, I think give me a follow up to Dread first, and then we can talk Akira.
I would gladly pay money to go and see Dread 2.
Yeah. Anything that gets us closer to seeing the Dark Judges on screen can only be a good thing, as far as I'm concerned. And people are still talking about Dread. All the major players involved in Dread are still wanting to do it. So all we got to do is find ourselves a billionaire and we can get this greenlit. So that's all that seems to be missing at the minute, is just someone to write us a check. So.
Well, we had to wait that long for Mad Max Fury Road. You never know.
I know, but I don't want to wait 30 years for another sequel to Dread. Talking of things which have been a long time coming, I finally got round to watching Gundam Wing for the first time. Gundam Wing, for the fans who know already, is currently celebrating its 38th anniversary at the moment. So there's been lots of exciting things happening, Gundam related. Crunchyroll are showing the old series and several of the other series as well. Mysteriously, they've not been showing Gundam Seed or Destiny, which is a bit frustrating because Seed is obviously the one I came up with. Really enjoyed that series throughout, and now I've just gone back and I'm starting right at the beginning with the original Gundam Wing, and I'm a couple of episodes in, and it's really exciting and interesting to watch. Yes, the animation is a little dated, which can be a bit jarring, but if you can get past your animation snobbery, then there's still a lot to enjoy there. Other than that, the other animation which has been holding my attention is Attack on Titan. Stephen, are you... I mean, no, you're not the biggest anime fan. Have you caught the Attack on Titan bug yet? Or
you've resisted it? I haven't. I haven't, and I avoided they did a live action Japanese live action version of it last year. I can't remember if it was a one or two parter, and it had such miserable reviews. I thought I'm not buying into this. However, you talk about Gundam. The interesting thing is, although I've never partaken of the animation, when I was much younger and possibly getting on for 38 years ago. I got, when I was a sort of a young kid, I got hold of some Gundam kits, you know, like Airfix sort of kits, but sort of the Japanese models. And I made a few. I love giant robots, and so I guess even at an early age, the connection was there.
It's one of those things that culturally has always been in the background. So I think a lot of people are aware of what Gundam is. They're just obviously more than likely not seeing the actual cartoon that goes with it, or anime, should we say. So it's one of those big cultural things. And Attack on Titan has become this big cultural series. If you've yet to see the series, basically it's set in this world where humanity is sort of walled up in this sea to protect themselves from these man-eating giants known as Titans. And we follow this young boy as he goes through the corpse and joins the fight to battle these Titans and obviously try and discover where they're coming from. This series is absolutely epic in scale. The first series, 25 episodes, covers the first 5 years. And like Game of Thrones, this is a show you don't want to get attached to any characters because they can be killed off at any time. And trust me, this show will stomp all over your emotions remorselessly. At the moment, they are doing the simulcast on Crunchyroll with Japan. So it's kind of been shown an hour after it's shown in Japan. And just watching the first episode of season two, I'm just hooked all over again. This show is just absolutely fantastic. And even if you're not a big anime fan, I think there's still enough great storytelling there. There's enough action and still enough splatter there to make it an interesting enough series. Just to give it a curious watch, if only to see what the hype's about. As for the live action version, I've still to see that myself. So,
so once again, you're trying to stop me having even any more free time because you're trying to get me to go and watch something else. It's damn you, Elwood.
I'm just throwing these things out there. Whether people choose to follow or not, that's completely up to them. We're just letting people know what's out there. We're just providing a service here. Obviously, onto our featured viewing for this episode, we are talking about King Kong Escapes. As I said, this is released in 1967. This was the second release from Toho after King Kong vs. Godzilla. Noteworthy at the time for having King Kong come first in the title because he was considered the bigger star than Godzilla. Now, with the sort of rights to King Kong sort of running out for Toho, they decided to take a second crack, and especially with King Kong vs. Godzilla being such a box office success, they here teamed up with Rankin and Bass, who is probably best known for their Christmas specials. And they also produced the Saturday morning cartoon The King Kong Show, which this film in particular is based on. Now, the film itself is directed by Ishiro Honda, who is probably best known as being like one of the key directors of the Godzilla franchise. And here he teams up with the other Godzilla fathers, which includes producer Tomoyuki Tanaka, composer Akira Ikufumi, and most noteworthy of all, special effects legend Isho Tsuburaya, who come together to create this kaiju version of Kong once again. The film itself, it sees the evil scientist Doctor Who, not to be confused with the time-traveling one. This is evil Japanese scientist called Doctor who has created his own mechie version of King Kong called Mechani Kong. And he plans to use this robot to dig for this mysterious element called Element X, which he can only find in the North Pole. And unfortunately, the radiation that it emits causes his creation to shut down. Now, at the same time, we've got the American commander, submarine commander, Commander Nelson, who, along with his crew, have discovered King Kong living on Mondo Island. And through this discovery, Doctor Who plans to kidnap Kong and use him to extract this Element X by hypnotizing the giant ape. And of course, you know, monster madness ensues. Stephen, I mean, what's your sort of opening thoughts on King Kong Escapes?
Okay, on a bit of extended journey to this. So when you told me that's what we were going to be doing this episode, I thought, oh, blimey, am I going to track that down? Literally 2 days later, I'm in Tesco's, and not only is there King Kong Escapes there, but King Kong versus Godzilla, both for a fiver each. And I thought, well, all right, it's meant to be. I picked them up. And they were the American cuts and dubs. So, you know, you understand, maybe you're not getting the entire picture. King Kong versus Godzilla is clearly, there's a great film in there somewhere, but it's it's devastated by the American side of things with action halting moments of bizarre television programs sort of explaining the plot to you and some terrible science along the way. But you know, there was stuff in there, and once we got to sort of the back end of the movie, it was a good laugh. King Kong Escapes, on the other hand, is clearly sort of an American Japanese production from the off, isn't it? And I thought it was a huge amount of fun, flawed only by some confusing stuff in the second half of the film where characters' motivations and geography seem to go a bit askew. But you accept these kind of movies for what they are, you know, if you're going to accept this as people in rubber suits stomping over miniatures, then you know, you've taken that on board. And taking that on board, I really, really enjoy King Kong Escapes.
That's kind of a relief. It's either going to go one of two ways when you give someone a kaiju movie. They're either going to really enjoy it for what it is, or they're going to start poking holes in essentially the fact that it's just, as you said, it's just a guy in a rubber suit. I mean, this one obviously falls during the sort of chop socky era of kaiju movies. So at this point, Godzilla is becoming more humanized, as we see in like Godzilla vs. Monster Zero, where he's obviously seen doing the Highland Fling in space. And this one actually falls just before perhaps one of the greatest Godzilla movies, Destroyer Monsters. So we do get to see in advance a couple of monsters who would appear in that one. In particular, we get to see a sea serpent that looks like Mandra. And we also get to see Baragon, who is completely different than the Baragon that we obviously see in Frankenstein Conquers the World. That mainly due to issues with the suit and in particular some dubbing issues on air. Destroy Monsters, but that's beside the point. Here we're obviously getting to see Kong fight a dinosaur, and this comes real quick in the film. We're not having to hang around here. This isn't like the Peter Jackson version where you're having to wait an hour or something before you see a dinosaur. You get, what, 10, 15 minutes into this film, and we're having Kong fighting Baragon.
We are, indeed. And that also, of course, is utterly respectful to the original King Kong movie, which King Kong fights a dinosaur, right?
Of course.
One of the first things we see him. So that's one of the things I actually liked about it, is that it took its time. I mean, we had some stuff with, was it Mechani Kong to start with? But once King Kong wakes up, and he is the sleepiest giant monster of all time over these two movies. But, you know, you get down to it, and it feels respectful of the original. It's hitting some of the same beats and ideas, and it's, yeah, certainly the first half of the movie is really good.
Yeah, clearly they realised here that you need to have dinosaurs. I mean, this is something that the 76 version of King Kong clearly missed out on the fact, because if we remember that version, I think all we got was just a giant snake. There was no dinosaurs. And I think that was always one of the things which disappointed me about that film. Not the fact that Kong doesn't climb the Empire State Building, which, if we remember correctly, was on vacation that week and hence led Kong to climb the Twin Towers instead. In this one, Kong gets to have a battle with Mechani Kong on the Tokyo Tower, which again stands in for the Empire State. But yeah, the actual fight scene between Kong and Baragon is really enjoyable. It's a fun little brawl that they have, even though it does end in quite brutal fashion with Baragon getting his jaw broken and seemingly being beaten to death by Kong. But obviously, he got over whatever he was suffering with, because he appears in Destroyer Monsters in the next sort of film in the series. So
that's exactly what happened. Well, it's an unnamed dinosaur in the original King Kong, but that's exactly how he kills him. He breaks his jaws open. So yeah. that was great. And the other thing which struck me upon viewing it sort of rather initially, there is this sort of feeling in this kind of film in the 60s, there's this desire for some great overarching world order, isn't there? So what they're expecting out of the United Nations as some kind of overall controlling influence over the world. So all our heroes here work for sort of the United Nations, don't they? and it reminded me of almost like a sort of a Gerry Anderson world, you know, where it's, I can't remember what they're called, but you remember like
International Rescue.
Well, not just at that, but like Captain Scarlet lives, you know, he operates on this international, for this international organization that's protecting the world, you know.
Okay.
And also with the on their submarine, they've got that little flying car boat hovercraft thing, you know, and that just, it just made me think of Gerry Anderson cartoons, all TV21 style. And even more so when we get to meet Doctor Who and our other antagonist. It feels like a cross between a kaiju movie and an episode of A Man from U.N.C.L.E. with a little dash of a John Pertwee era Doctor Who, not wanting to doubly confuse the use of Doctor Who in this chat. But it was just a lovely aesthetic going on.
Yeah, definitely. And obviously with the whole setup, I mean, it is derived from the King Kong show, that Saturday morning cartoon in which Kong basically was battling like mad scientists, aliens, you know, robots, space monsters, whatever, you know, usual Saturday morning fare that they felt like drafting him against that particular episode. And here it's essentially the same. We have Kong, in this case, he's battling, you know, he battles a dinosaur and throws a rock at a sea serpent, which is just unbelievably funny, the fact he managed to actually hit it like head on with a rock. And we obviously have the big showdown with his Mechie version. So it's all sort of ties into that. And the actual villain of Doctor Who, which is so confusing, especially as British viewers watching this, not to think of the Time Lord when we're obviously watching this movie, whenever it says Doctor Who. And I thought while I was watching it that it may be like a mispronunciation that I heard. It was like Dr. Wu or something,
well,
like
that. I believe it is Dr. Wu in its original tongue. So I guess it's just that kind of corruption comes along, doesn't it?
Yeah. But I mean, I think one of the best things about Doctor Who is the fact he has the sexy henchwoman, Madame Piranha, played by Mi Hammer of You Only Live Twice fame. Probably the one of the hottest Bond girls ever.
Well, and made in the same year as You Only Live Twice as well. So this was a busy year for her. Yeah, she is one of the hottest Bond girls ever. And that was one moment of racial insensitivity aside. It's probably one of the best James Bond films for minute-to-minute action and fun.
Yeah. But when you look at Doctor Who's lair here, it does seem to resemble Blofeld's lair from that film.
Doesn't it just? You know, she must have... Not to add in her contract, she always has to go to the same place or something like that.
But I mean, she has the amount of outfit changes, though, she has. She's at the North Pole, yet she has, like, the most extensive wardrobe of any character in this film.
She's one fashionable lady for the 60s, isn't she?
Oh, definitely.
But, bizarrely, so halfway through the film, it suddenly sort of suggests that you should have seen this cartoon so you understand the relationships between... Apparently Commander Nelson and Doctor Who have previous that hadn't been mentioned before, and it feels like if you had watched the cartoon, you'd be much more informed about what was going on here. And then with My Hammer's character, she suddenly sort of jumps around a bit what her motivations are, and she turns from being the femme fatale to almost a heroine, doesn't she? It's all very strange. The second half of the film sort of really jumps around in terms of characterization.
Yeah.
Well, and the same is true. So we have our American leading lady in the Fay Wray role, which is Linda Miller. She seems to have affections for the Japanese American Lieutenant Nomura. But then half the time she's got her arms around Commander Nelson, and it's all very confusing. And it's almost as if they're making it up on the fly. And the reason I sort of mentioned this is you mentioned about My Hammer's sort of costume changes. I don't know if you noticed, but she sort of clearly one costume change has been rejigged, and she's wearing it, and then 20 minutes later she's wearing it again, but she had changed at least twice in the meantime.
So. I didn't actually notice that, but then again, it's in the most confusing. I don't know what's supposed to be going on, because once we get to, they get taken to Doctor Who's base, and I love the whole build up to that is that they're looking for Kong and where Doctor Who could have obviously taken Kong to, and it's like, oh, I don't think he'd be in the North Pole. Oh, wait a minute, that's exactly where he is. And that apparently Japan is in the middle of the ocean, according to his map skills, because he just randomly points to Kong's possible location on the map, and it's like the middle of the ocean, and it's supposed to somehow symbolize Tokyo.
There's some, because when they're captured to take them to the North Pole, they fly there in a twin-engine prop plane from Indonesia. I promise you, in 1967, that ain't going to happen. and then a bit later on, when Kong escapes from the North Pole, he goes to Tokyo. Now, it's made clear he's a reasonable swimmer. not that reasonable and not that fast, one assumes. And it's the whole, you know, the film is obviously trying to get us to a point where Kong and his mechanical facsimile are going to do battle on the streets of Tokyo.
Yeah.
Climb the Tokyo Tower, and, you know, it's trying to be like a Japanese version of King Kong in that sense. But the it's a little ridiculous how things play out. Why did he go there? What inspired him to go there? I'll never understand. But you have to take some of these things, you just have to run with them, don't you?
I think because giant monsters are instantly drawn to Japan. It's like in their DNA that they just feel compelled to go and visit there at one point or another. So
there's probably how currents move or something like that. But they all do, don't they? They all have to go to Japan.
Yeah, but we have to note that Kong doesn't actually wreck anything in Tokyo at all. It's only when Mechani Kong turns up that things start getting destroyed, and we get the traditional sort of kaiju action of Tokyo being reduced to rubble. Because apparently Mechani Kong doesn't really care for roads or buildings that stand its way. It just has a very direct path that it goes in its mission to confront Kong.
Yeah, and that just reminded me as well. At the beginning of the film, the reason Doctor Who and Madame Piranha, isn't it?
Yeah.
Go and get Kong is because Mechani Kong breaks down when mining this mysterious element X. Yet, half an hour later, he's back in the Blofeld headquarters. But he was stuck down in the mine. It really is weird. The first half of the film is put together quite carefully,
yeah,
and setting everything up. And then it just goes, you know what? Let's just fling everything at the screen and see what happens. It's huge amount of fun, don't get me wrong. But don't come to this one if you're looking for logic.
Oh, I love the fact that you say it's so carefully put together. We arrive on Mondo Island, and apparently the budget can't support a whole tribe of people, so we get one old Japanese actor who's been painted orange, because apparently they finally decide to wise up on the fact you can't do blackface.
Oh my gosh. Well, King Kong versus Godzilla is an incredibly uncomfortable watch in that regard, isn't it? Because they blackface up about 40 or 50 Japanese people.
Oh yeah.
And I'm like, I don't know how to react to this. You know, part of you thinking, well, this is what they did at the time, isn't right. It's just how it was. And some of it's thinking, no, and no level could this ever have been right. It's just,
yeah. For some reason, I'm more able to get past when I see like blackfacing like Asian productions than I am when I see like John Wayne playing Genghis Khan in The Conqueror, or when we see when we look at the Johnny Five movies, the Short Circuit films, and we've got a white actor blacked up to play an Indian actor, apparently so convincingly that years later, people didn't actually realise he wasn't an Indian actor.
Oh, really? But then, of course, we've got Mickey Rooney in Breakfast at Tiffany's, and then on the other side, you have Ben Kingsley playing Gandhi. So it's a thing, I guess, but it's... if people want to, just going back to our last film, if you want to complain about Ghosts in the Shell, there's plenty of other bigger targets, right?
Yes. But yeah, this poor old Japanese man who's been brought in to play this islander who gets randomly bumped off by Doctor Who, doesn't apparently take kindly to being told that he can't kidnap Kong. I have to obviously say that Kong is probably... this is the easiest time I've seen Kong be captured, because basically he just has a bunch of smoke bombs dropped in from a helicopter, and then they use like those claw grabby machines to basically cast him off with four helicopters. And I think, well, that was kind of easy.
It is, but this Kong has definitely suffered some narcolepsy. He is constantly falling asleep. The first time we see him, he's sort of waking up from laying down. These bombs seem to send him to sleep. He nearly falls asleep, doesn't he, in the mine. There's something wrong with Kong. I don't know what it is, but I think he suffers some narcolepsy. People need to find out.
I mean, there's the same moment, just obviously look at this Kong suit, because this is obviously a kaiju reimagining of what King Kong is. And... yes, it's an improvement over the suit we saw in King Kong versus Godzilla, but this is still a very bad suit. I mean, it's not as bad as some of the monkey suits that we've seen in similar sort of ape movies when we look at things like Queen Kong or Ape. Those are some pretty atrocious monkey suits. But this one, you can tell that they've clearly tried to like put some humanity into the character. So he's got these big sympathetic eyes, but a lot of the time, as you said, he looks half asleep or stoned. So
he does. I mean, it's a step up from the gorilla in Trading Places, I guess. But it's I have to say, these suits, I mean, I read time and time again when I'm reading up about these kind of films, how the suits get damaged, and I just suggest don't stand in giant tanks of water with them then, because I don't think that's going to do them the world of good. But I thought the suit was fine. You know, you accept a certain level of naffness around these things,
yeah,
and that's part of the charm, I think, isn't it? And as these things go, I thought the Kong suit was fine. Like you say, I think it actually does show that the facial side of things actually quite works. You know, I think you get a sense of his emotional side, and I quite like the Mechie Kong suit all round, really. I thought that was great.
Yeah, well, I mean, with the suits, they Toho like notorious for recycling suits. Like, you often see like Godzilla suits show up in Ultraman. There's an episode of Ultraman where they basically put a frill on the old Godzilla suit from Godzilla and Son, I believe the suit was from, and spray painted it. Now, with Japanese health and safety, they decided the best way to obviously recolor the suit is to have someone wear it, and then they spray painted it. And you would often find this time and time again when they're doing like the kaiju effects, that they would often strap explosives onto these suits and blow them up. And this is often with an actor inside. So it often fascinates me what passes for like Asian health and safety, especially in Japanese and Hong Kong filmmaking, because it always seemed to be like the two which seemed to be pushing it further each time.
I don't think they have anything like the health and safety rules we have in the West. just in general, not around filmmaking, just full stop.
But we've obviously in the suit this time we've got Haru Nakajima, who is probably noteworthy for his work he did in the Godzilla suit. I mean, he did a lot of the key films of that sort of era, from like Invasion of the Astro Monsters through to like Godzilla vs. Megalon, and he did obviously do some like cameo appearances as a live action actor. So here he's obviously doing his Kong version, and I feel he does a really good job. I mean, both himself and Yu Sidika do really great like monster suit work in this. The fight scene on the Tokyo Tower in particular is really enjoyable to watch. It's daft, but it's really kind of fun just to see these two giant apes battling on top of the Tokyo Tower. I mean, did you like the action sequences throughout this, or...?
Oh, I really did. I mean, we already spoke about the dinosaur fight at the beginning. That does have a bit of a laugh, because the dinosaur does sort of like flying two-footed kicks at Kong, doesn't he? But I'm a huge fan of the original Godzilla, right?
Yeah.
But I think you have to put that to the side, and it's a different sort of film to what they became later on in the various sort of iterations and phases. I'm aware of them all. But actually, this one really stands up. I think it, the you know, we build up to this, to the fight between the two versions of Kong, and we get there at the end of, I don't know, was it an hour and a half or something like that, and I think it was worth it at the end. The special effects are fine. Again, comparing it with King Kong versus Godzilla, where a lot of the moments are ruined because of the terrible, I guess they're using CSO, aren't they, sort of color separating overlays to try and put real people in the scenes at the same time.
Yeah,
here it wasn't so bad. It was great. I had an absolute blast. And you know, as you know, I am not the biggest kaiju fan in the world. I've watched a few, and I always enjoy them when I watch them, but I'm not going to protect it because I'm a kaiju fan, yeah, which I think can happen, and I'm willing to accept its flaws because it's a charming film and it gives you what you want at the end. You want to see the giant ape take on the giant robot, don't you? And it does that, and it's it you know, within the context of it being filmed in 1967 on a fairly limited budget, really, even in those days, I think it succeeds in spades.
There are some questionable moments throughout. There's certainly some interesting dub work. In particular, Linda Miller hated that they've dubbed her voice in the American version, but she actually loved the actress who did her voice in the Japanese version, which was Kiko Santoro.
And wasn't this because she was technically a model?
Yes.
And not an actress, and therefore she couldn't use her own voice or something like that? Weird.
It's basically the fact that Rod Reason was able to redub his lines because he was part of the Screen Actors Guild. But as you said, Linda Miller, she was just a model, so she has no rights to ask to redub her lines at all. She's not covered at all. So I think
she was just a model who happened to be in Japan at the time, and they were saying, well, they want a Western woman to be in it. I mean, what a wonderful opportunity that was. Didn't exactly create a great career for her, but I think she's actually quite fine, even if she is the victim of some quite casual sexism across the early part of the film.
Well, she's the object of lust. I mean, she's not only the object of lust between our submarine commander Nelson here, but also, as you said, Nomaru as well, here played by Akira Takarada, who is another Godzilla mainstay. He's put in several appearances throughout the Toho movies. I mean, you can see him in like Godzilla vs. the Sea Monster or Emperor Horror of the Deep, to give it its proper UK title, and the title I commonly refer to. I mean, he also appears in Invasion of the Astro Monsters, which is also it's noteworthy, the fact that we've got some of these reoccurring actors here. In particular, we also get to see Andrew Hughes, who would appear in Destroy All Monsters, with a really weird dub in the UK version where he just sounded like a old man struggling to talk, but here he shows up as a United Nations journalist, and it's kind of interesting to see him, of all people, appear in this film. So
it certainly has. So with the other kaiju films I've seen that have had sort of American reworks, it always feels quite clumsy. You know, because they're obviously trying to put, let's be honest, they're trying to put a white face in it so that it's more acceptable to a Western audience. But here, because it's from first principles, very much a joint operation, it felt quite seamless to me.
Yeah, I think when it comes to the Godzilla movies, I mean, there's only a couple where they actually edited American footage in. Both cases with Raymond Blur. He plays a newscaster in the American version of Godzilla, which was released as Godzilla King of the Monsters. He's also shows up if you watch the alternate version of, I believe it's Return of Godzilla or Godzilla 1984. They reworked the story, so he's now has a psychic connection with Godzilla, which is kind of random. And it's also a completely garbage version of what is actually a pretty good movie. So if you get a chance, always watch the Japanese version because it's just infinitely better.
That goes without saying, I think, for anything like that. I'm always a subtitles over dubbing person, so the fact that an American version might have different scenes or different edits, I think on the whole I would try and avoid it, but circumstance sometimes means that's all you get, right?
I know what you mean, and there are obviously other Godzilla movies where they, as I said, they cast English actors. I mean, we got Nick Adams shows up in Invasion of the Astro Monsters. We also have, as I mentioned already, we've got people like Andrew Hughes, who turns up in Destroy All Monsters, which would obviously be the film that Ishiro Honda would go on to make after this film, and is well worth checking out. But I'm going to talk about that one a little bit later. The only issue I have with this film is that when we get to the North Pole, and we have Commander Nelson here, who's basically having this confrontation with Doctor Who. Meanwhile, we've obviously got Nomaru and Susan, who are basically being frozen in their cell. They're going through all this awful thing, and he's basically been trying to be seduced by Madame Piranha. He's got Doctor Who trying to charm him over a game of chess, and it seemed that we had all these like random sides where he's off socializing and they're sort of on the blunt end of any sort of particular torture or nastiness. It just seemed like such a weird way of doing those particular scenes, and it was kind of confusing what was supposed to actually be going on there. So
that was absolutely the part of the film where it just went, what, huh, what's your plan? I've watched it twice and I'm still none really the wiser of what was trying to be achieved here. So now I've already spoken about how Madame Piranha suddenly changes sides. So it's okay to bomb the whole world, but setting a giant ape on Tokyo is not right. They're really weird about what country she comes from, aren't they? And then, like you say, they do this strange thing where they sort of try and freeze two of them to death, but seduce the other one and then rescue one of them and not rescue it. And it's like, what on earth is going on? And then I decided, do you know what? Life's too short. I'm just going to run with this and just see what happens.
I think the only thing more confusing is the connection that Kong has with Susan. And obviously, as you mentioned already, I mean, they're trying to rework that Fey-Ray connection, where Kong is obviously attracted to beautiful Western women. And the sexism in particular, in that particular scene, when they get back to the United Nations and Commander Nelson's basically trying to explain that they found Kong with no photographic proof or anything, that people are just taking him on his word that Kong is on this island and that he's obviously can be controlled to an extent by Susan. And it's sort of like, it's like, well, look at her. She's a beautiful woman. I'm thinking, wow, that's not at all sexist, is it?
I mean, if it's been a British, you know, you can imagine Alfie, you know, so he's just a cracking bird, isn't she, or something like that. And everyone's just sort of just nodding in the press corps. My favourite bit of casual sexism in the film, though, is when they go back to the island.
Yeah.
And they're trying to find Kong. They get on their little supercar again, don't they? And they park up, and the three of them get out. And the commander goes, you stay here, it could be a bit dangerous. They literally walk two steps and find the sort of the remnants of the bombs or something like that. And then it's all, I'm getting confused. No, that's when they first go, isn't it? She's all excited about going to the island.
Yeah.
They stop, they tell her to wait there and then walk off. The two guys, the two manly men go off, and then she's threatened by the dinosaur, which brings it all in. Yes, I've confused two parts of the film, but it's very confused because it clearly wants to make her to be important and that Kong loves her and blah, 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 all the whole Fey-Ray thing going on. And clearly, there's a moment early in the film, isn't there, where some of the other submariners sort of say, hey, it's really good having a hot woman on board, isn't it? And you think,
oh yeah, this is within minutes of the film being open, we've got such casual sexism being thrown around. So
at that point, she gives them she sort of turns it on them, doesn't she, and sort of turns it back and says, hey, I'm the lieutenant, you do what you're told, and you think, yeah, well done you, but then the rest of the film decides not to follow up with that at all.
No.
And then turns Madame Piranha from quite a interesting, potentially dark character again to something quite she's in control, she's the boss, isn't she, and then suddenly utterly submissive to the Western men, and it's a bit disappointing really, but it's 1967, I'm afraid.
Well, I mean, Madame Piranha is obviously representing this mysterious country. Her origins, we're not sure. I think we have a scene where Commander Nelson's basically like, you're not Chinese, Japanese, Thai, Philippine. It's like, reeling it off.
Every Asian country, and you think, well, I'm none the wiser where she's from either. One assumes she's from Vietnam, I think is what they're trying to probably say. Everything what's going on in the world at the time, but it's not clear. And what actually her plan ever was is a bit mysterious as well, but...
Well, let's not forget that we obviously have the scene where Doctor Who's lackeys go to pick up our trio in the plane, which they're seemingly more than happy to just go along with. And Nomaru comments on the pilot, is like, they're not Japanese. And it's like, well, they very clearly are Japanese actors, so I don't know where you think they've come from.
And that's the Japanese-American guy saying that, right?
Yeah.
No, but they're not Japanese. Oh, let's just get a plane anyway. And it's like just weird stuff going on. But again, isn't that part of the charm? That's why we're here.
I know.
If it's utterly straightforward and utterly PC, I think this film would be 90% less enjoyable.
It sort of like knows when it's getting too stupid, because when we've got this whole back and forth, obviously, between Nelson and Doctor Who and stuff, it clearly gets to a point where it's just getting stupid, and at that point, Kong goes absolutely nuts and starts breaking out of itself. But then again, he did have like the world's smallest chain on, so I think it was just kind of wishful thinking by Doctor Who that he wasn't going to break that. We also learn in this film that Kong can actually be hypnotized through the magic of a flashing crystal.
And he understands English perfectly.
Apparently so. And Mechani Kong also sounds like he's got a disco siren when he moves, which is kind of fun.
Oh, and there was the other strange bit. Do you remember when Kong is incarcerated up in the North Pole? He's in this giant cage which they've built, and he sees the mysteriously rescued Mechani Kong over the other side of the hangar. And he sort of looks at it and says, "Oh," and it sort of superimposes another Kong face on top of the mechanical Kong. Thinking, are we going somewhere where we're saying that he thinks it's a woman or something? I really didn't know where we were going to go with that, but it never really goes anywhere, does it? There's this whole midsection of the film which is just utterly random.
Well, I mean, it's fair to say. I mean, where are all these giant apes coming from? Because we only ever see one at a time. Where are these apes coming from? We never see any female apes. We just obviously see Kong every time, and no matter what happens to him, there's always a replacement Kong by the next film to take his place. So,
yeah, the fact they do hint about this actually in another scene in the film, because there's not only a giant gorilla, but there's an island full of bloody dinosaurs. I mean, surely that in and of itself is worthy of an expedition of something more than three people in a submarine. But yeah, but I think that's a common, the sort of the kaiju films I've seen either are accepting of a continuity, or they just ignore past continuity, and this one very much is in the ignore category, right?
Yeah, I would say pretty much so. So, but I mean, do we have any sort of final thoughts on this one at all? Or?
Do you know what? I'm going to thank you for recommending this film, because when you suggested it, I like I said at the beginning, I was a bit like, oh God, not that I did misjudge your taste, but I thought it was going to be much less all-round fun for all sorts of reasons than it actually was. So it's probably in nobody's top 10 kaiju films of all time, but I really got a kick out of it, so thank you.
That's okay. I'm not sure that's going to obviously continue with some of the films that we have planned in this series, but yeah, I'm glad that you enjoyed it. It's, as I said, it's one of the better kaiju movies out there, especially in the giant ape genre. So if you're obviously looking at like exploitation movies, there is a lot of very bad ape movies out there, because you obviously have good ones like Mighty Peking Man, and you have really awful ones like the aforementioned Ape, which is just it's just painful from like start to finish. And if you want to, if you still like want to watch it at all, I mean, just watch Brendan over at Brendan Coote's Movie Reviews, who does like a summarized version of the plot for it, and it's probably the more bearable way to watch it than trying to watch that one straight, that's for sure. So,
well, saying that, I've always enjoyed, I mean, it's not a kaiju film, it's an American film, I always liked Mighty Joe Young. That was one of the staples of my childhood on like BBC Two regularly, along with the sort of the Seven Faces of Mr. Lau, whatever it was, you know. No, I like Mighty Joe Young. So, I'm not against a giant ape.
Yeah, I mean, for some reason, Mighty Joe Young, despite obviously coming out before King Kong, always seems to get lost in the mix. And we always seem to forget about this wonderful giant ape movie. I mean, the same thing, way that we forget about the follow-up to King Kong, Son of Kong. We only seem to in our subconscious, we seem to think there's only been three Kong movies. We got King Kong, King Kong 76, and Peter Jackson's King Kong from 2005. And obviously now we've got the new one, Kong Skull Island, to go with that. But there's obviously been more than just these films. I mean, obviously, just going through the straight King Kong biography, we've obviously got Son of Kong, which was released the same year as King Kong. We've then go into the kaiju ones with King Kong vs. Godzilla and our aforementioned King Kong Escapes. Then we got King Kong 76, which was followed up in 86 by King Kong Lives, which, interestingly enough, you can also pick up at Tesco for the same price that you probably paid for these two. So,
hey, it's my new go-to place for movies. I've never come across anything which really wasn't sort of top 20 films there before, and there they were. More than one copy of them, so
yeah, I think that's the great thing when you have something like King Kong gets remade, is that you'll find the supermarkets will wheel out like a vanilla disc of the classic versions. It certainly happened with when Peter Jackson's King Kong comes out, that we saw the disc for King Kong vs. Godzilla and King Kong Escapes come out. So I'm always kind of happy when kind of happy and frustrated at the same time, because it's frustrating the fact they're remaking it, but happy the fact that we get an updated version of the old film. So, but yeah, I mean, did you like the Peter Jackson version?
I've never seen it. I'm going to fess up now.
Okay.
I love Peter Jackson's early movies.
Yeah.
I'm not a fan of his. So I love Heavenly Creatures and some of the his more horror-oriented stuff earlier on, Brain Dead and things like that, but I can't stand movies that are 3 hours long. So it's not just King Kong, and you know, people are going to throw darts at me now. I can't stand the Lord of the Rings films. I can't stand The Hobbit, and I'm afraid King Kong's in that thing where I think you should be able to tell a story within 2 hours, especially a story that's been told before.
Yeah. I mean, I like the Jackson version. It's a journey. It's like an adventure film, which is something that's missing from cinema at the moment, in my personal opinion. There's none of these like grand adventure films, like, you know, like King Solomon's Mines and those sort of movies where you go into strange places and you're seeing wondrous things. And that's what I love about the Peter Jackson version. Yes, it is completely fanboy material, and you can tell that when he'd obviously made the studio loads of money by doing the Lord of the Rings trilogy, that he'd taken advantage of being given carte blanche to do exactly what he wanted, just basically ran with it and gave us the 3 hour version of King Kong, that you can even get a longer version still, if you so wish. But yeah,
I'm too old for that.
Just break it up. That's what you got to do. That's what DVDs are. The DVDs hold your place, don't they, sir?
Well, absolutely. When people like you and me have to watch so many films, not always by choice, I'm afraid a lot of film watching is fragmented, and so the DVD and Blu-ray and streaming era are fantastic for that.
But yeah, but no, King Kong Escapes. It's one that's viewed in the sort of upper echelon of kaiju movies. One put like the likes of like Mothra and Destroyer Monsters and certainly the more fun sort of Godzilla movies, really, from like Invasion of the Astro Monsters through to like Terror Mechagodzilla, that sort of era of Godzilla movies. This is falls very much firmly within it. And well, Honra is not perhaps giving his low angles and giving a sense of scale with this. This is very much a pay-to-play project. You can feel like he's just basically took this project on because he's like Toho's go-to guy for giant monster movies, it seems. And he brings a lot of fun elements to the film, and it's just fun escapist sort of kaiju movie. It's nothing too serious, and there's certainly a lot of fun to be had, even if it is completely daft. We're going to take a quick break. When we return, though, we will be looking at our further viewing.
Why haven't you seen Jaws?
I've seen Finding Nemo. That's close enough, right?
Why haven't you seen The Usual Suspects?
Because I already know who Kaiser Soze is.
I can't believe you haven't seen Videodrome.
What? Has anyone seen Videodrome?
You haven't seen Psycho?
Okay. How about I start a podcast where someone will introduce me to one of these great movies I've never seen before, and in return, I'll have them watch a superhero movie. Film-wise, the Why Haven't You Seen This Film podcast. Find it on iTunes or Stitcher Radio.
And we're back. Onto our further viewing now. This is the part of the show where we obviously recommend our films that we would like to pair our selection with. Obviously, for King Kong Escapes, it's a kaiju movie, so it should really come as little surprise that what we're going to be going with for this one. But Stephen, I mean, do you want to go first with what you've chosen for this one?
Okay, I will. And I'll not only go first, but I'll go back to the first, to the original King of the Monsters, I guess, to the very first Godzilla movie from 1954, I think. So it's where it all started. It's a black and white film, shock horror, and it again really stands up today. I think it's a bit of a darker film than the one that we've just discussed. The black and white really works, so a lot of the hokiness maybe of some of the later movies isn't there because of the way black and white works in hiding some flaws in model work and in costume work. But it's got a really serious genesis in terms of this is made within a decade of the atomic bombs going off in Japan, the sort of the subtext of what's going on and the impact that's had on Japanese society, because this Godzilla is woken, isn't it, by American atomic testing in the Pacific. And it's just a really solid film. It's an iconic film because guess what? It spawned a whole bunch of, well, multiple franchises, and we're still remaking it today in the West. So if you can find a good copy of the original Japanese film, and I think the BFI do one here in the UK, I couldn't recommend it more. It's a fantastic film.
Oh, definitely. So the original Godzilla is, it's interesting because it's compared to the films which followed, it's a very sober and dark monster movie. We obviously have scenes of field hospitals in the aftermath of Godzilla's attack. We obviously have that iconic scene of the mother huddling her children while buildings are collapsing around her. And it's very, it's such a wonderful film. And again, this is just Holder, the way he chooses to shoot Godzilla, he shoots from low angles, and we get a real sense of scale and size with the monster in this one. The film itself drawing inspiration from a group of fishing vessels that actually accidentally sailed into a nuclear testing area, and that was part of the origin of this film being created. The name itself, obviously, was supposed to, the original Godzilla was supposed to be a combination of a gorilla and a whale, if you haven't believe it. Thankfully, they made some alterations and it became the iconic creation it is now. Apparently, the name Godzilla was also taken from a nickname given to one of the stagehands on the Toho set, which has been proven and disproven over the years, but it's completely up to yourself, obviously, how you wish to go with that. But no, Godzilla is a completely iconic movie. I couldn't agree more, Stephen. And you're right in saying that if you're going to watch this, watch the original Japanese cut, not the Godzilla, the King of the Monsters American cut that is obviously floating around on various labels there. Most noteworthy for including Raymond Blair as the American newscaster, which they worked in basically so they could sell it to the American audiences by saying, oh, look, here's all these Japanese actors, but wait, there's an American actor for you.
Yeah, I'm afraid that's nature of the beast at the time, I suppose. But at the same time, I mean, I know you've spoken to other people about this kind of thing. In the UK, our experiences with Godzilla films are not as common. So in America, this is real Saturday morning fare, isn't it? All the Godzilla films, they've all had American dubs or re-edits and things like that, and it's much more deeply rooted in their in a certain age of person's childhood. And in the common cinematic and entertainment language of people, which much more than it is here in the UK.
Oh, definitely. So when we look at how Japan views these films, I mean, the being offered to direct a Godzilla movie is considered to have the same honor that a British director being offered the chance to direct a Bond movie. They view it at that high level. And obviously, to Western audiences, we just view these just like hokey, you know, monster-sized SmackDown movies. But no, there's actually a lot of honor and tradition with the series. And Toho, the head of Toho's jersey, is so protective over the Godzilla properties, which has made it such a pain to get them released over here, and meant that more than likely, if you're in the UK, chances are that the only way you've been able to see them all is if you purchase yourself a multi-region player or found someone to convert the tapes for you. But yeah, you're right. In America, it's sort of like Saturday morning fare for ourselves in Britain. I mean, this was sort of like late night Channel 4 viewing, really, wasn't it? So
if you're lucky, and probably the same six showing over and over again. And of course, sitting on my laptop now, waiting for probably my next review, I'm going to do at Guelo Ramblings, is the new Shin Godzilla. So the latest offering, which by all accounts is much more like the original, the very first film. So it'll be interesting to see that when I get round to watching it.
Cool. As for myself, I'm going to go with one of the high points of the Godzilla series. So you're getting a Godzilla double bill from both myself and Steven for this edition of further viewing. We're going to go with the 1968 Destroyer Monsters, again directed by Isao Honda. Also scripted by Takashi Kimura, who did King Kong Escapes. So we obviously have that connection. This would be the last film that the Godzilla fathers would work on as a group. They would obviously return as like one or two members to work on further films. Certainly Isao Honda would direct more Godzilla films in the series. And this was originally designed as the film which was going to mothball the series. They were going to like do this one big entry and it would end the series. Unfortunately, or complete surprise to the backers, it went on to be a huge success and meant the series continued for many years afterwards, giving it in many ways its second wind, this particular era of the Godzilla movies, continuing right through to the Terror of Mechagodzilla in sort of like the late 70s. The film itself, it sees all the monsters of the world rounded up and put onto this island known as Monsterland. And here they live in peace, and they got various security sort of things set up in place to stop them escaping and making a beeline to Japan whenever they get the urge. And they're living quite happily when mysteriously all the monsters disappear when they're kidnapped by the Kalaxis, who are this alien race, another common theme of this particular era of Godzilla movies, and they basically now might use mind control to send the monsters to destroy the cities of the world. And this film would be noteworthy, especially because it features this wonderful SmackDown where all these monsters team up to take on King Ghidorah in a monster-sized SmackDown, the likes that we probably wouldn't see until Godzilla Final Wars. Now, the reason I've chosen Destroyer Monsters, not only because it's my personal favourite, is the fact that in recent years, it's been wrongly bashed by a number of cult critics who have declared it as being hokey and rubbish, and I've never understood why. I mean, this is a movie where you get to see eight monsters have a fight at the end. You get to see Manila, for once, not being an irritating little sod that he is, that looks like grey lumpy mash. He's actually kind of adorable in this version. And basically, Toho, any monster that they had, they wheeled out. So we get to see Baragon again from, obviously, Return from King Kong Escapes. We get to see Mandra. We get to see a lot of the sort of key characters there, such as Mothra and Rodan. My personal favourite, Angulus, all getting big starring moments, as well as obviously the big guy himself, Godzilla, getting into set about destroying New York several years before he would obviously get a chance to do that in the 98 version. So if you get a chance, I mean, Destroyer Monsters is a fantastic entry in the series. And it's one of the few that it's actually not too bad to get hold of here in the UK. You can certainly pick it up on VHS, and more than likely you can probably pick it up on DVD as well by this point. But yeah, if you've not seen it, Destroy Monsters will be my pick for this particular episode.
And I'll wholeheartedly agree with that. It's one of the few I've seen. I actually reviewed it, I think, about 6 months ago. I was brought to it both because I'd listened to your interview with August Ragone, where you'd wax lyrical about it. But at the same time, I was rereading Warren Ellis's Planetary comic book. And first or second issue of that sort of has a look at the Monster Island or Island Zero, depending on what dub you're using. and it uses a very different way of looking at it. But I thought, oh, what a fantastic idea, an island prison for all these monsters, which may have brought me to Destroy All Monsters. And whilst I might not be as emotionally attached to some of these characters, and even though half of them are, it's another fabulous romp. And like you say, at the end, a whole bunch of monsters fight each other and take on a bigger monster. And what's not to love? It's a hugely entertaining film, and I'm very surprised that there is negative feelings towards it.
And that, I guess, brings us to the end of another edition of the Asian Cinema Film Club. Before we obviously wrap this one up, Stephen, it is your selection for episode 3. What are you going to go with?
Okay, well, for the last two episodes, we've hung around in Japan, and we've looked at a classic anime, and we've looked at a classic film studio, I suppose, in terms of Toho. So what I thought we'd do, I thought we'd move away from Japan for our next episode, and we'll go to Thailand, and we'll have a look at Wisit Sasanatieng's Tears of the Black Tiger, which is about as cult a Thai movie as you can find. It's a parody of Westerns and Thai soap operas, and I hopefully you'll have a blast with it.
It's certainly one that I've only seen once, and I'm kind of interested to see it again, because it's such an unusual film, and Thailand is one of those areas of Asian cinema which never seems to get a huge amount of love. I mean, when we think of Asian cinema, we just obviously think of Hong Kong, Japan, and South Korea. So we obviously tend to overlook these areas such as Thailand, which are obviously producing films of note.
It has a very good reputation for horror movies. So Thai horror movies are a class above most other Asian horror films. You probably know Shutter and a few others. But there's a great indie scene there. Well, the reason I've chosen this one, and we'll talk about it next time, is because it's like no other Thai film you'll have seen, and probably not many other Asian films you've seen, but I suspect you will draw some parallels with some other Asian filmmakers.
Cool. Well, I look forward to obviously discussing that one with you next. Coming up in the next episode of the Mad Bad and Downright Strange Showcase, I'm going to be sitting down with Zoe from the site Zobo with a Shotgun. We're going to be looking at Dog Soldiers, as well as taking what I'm sure will be a wonderful trip into the Amazon as we look at the always controversial Cannibal Holocaust. So that's coming up in the next episode. And then obviously Stephen will be back for episode 3 of the Asian Cinema Film Club, where it said we'll be looking at Tears of the Black Tiger. In the meantime, if people want to come and find you on the web and find your bits and pieces, Stephen, where is the best place to find you?
Okay, we can find my own blog at gwelorambling.wordpress.com, or you can see some of my other more varied writings and articles, along with plenty of others, at easternkicks.com. I think that's pretty much it at the moment.
Okay. Are you on the Twitter at all? Or?
I am on the Twitter. I'm on the Twitter at LPVO. That's ELPEEVIO. And if you want to email me, you can email me at thingsfallapart@hotmail.co.uk.
Fantastic. As for myself, it's on Twitter. It's at @Elwood_Jones. And you can obviously find my film writings at fromthedeptsofdvdhell.blogspot.co.uk. If you want to hear me talk about Buffy, you can do with that stuff at channelsuperhero.com, as well as my retro video reviews or the Game Warp stuff, which you can find at thatmomentin.com as well. Until next time, I'd like to thank my co-host, as always, Stephen, for joining me to discuss King Kong Escapes this evening.
Thank you very much for having me. Very enjoyable as ever.
Cool. And this is Edward Jones signing off another edition of the Asian Cinema Film Club. Remind you, as always, keep it strange. Hey! Hey!昨日の小麦は忘れて昨日のあの子は忘れて踊り続けていたい夜なのさ月が砕け散っても星が燃えて落ちても踊り続けていたい夜なのさ胸に刺さった恋の刃が燃える想いを狂わすのさ昨日の恋は忘れて昨日のあの子は忘れて踊り続けていたい夜なのさ